Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and welcome to another episode of the Silmarillion Seminar.
Hello and welcome to Silmarillion Seminar 16, in which we discuss Chapter 15 of the Quintus Silmarillion of the Noldor in Beleriand. This is Laura Burkholz, one of the Silmarillionaires, and you may also know me from the Secrets of Middle-earth podcast on SQPN.com. In today's episode, we discuss disappearing elves, ignoring good advice, the building of the elven strongholds, Gondolin and Nargothrond, and we say some not very nice things about Galadriel and Círdan. I hope you enjoy the episode.
Okay, good evening, everybody. I know we're missing a few people tonight, but we'll have to, struggle through as we can here. Okay, so I would like to start the primary topics that I definitely want to make sure we hit on are things pretty much people have already raised them somewhat here in our text queue. That is certainly the founding of Gondolin and Olmo's connection with that, and then also the whole Thingol and the Noldor issue. And then I would love to get back to talking about Galadriel, though probably with a little bit more politeness than Dave is typing about it right now. So, but anyway, let's start with. Mike started with a simple question about Thorondor, the king of the eagles, this is his name means, guess what? King of the Eagles. You can tell he's the King of the Eagles because that's his name. Thoron in Sindar in Sindarin means eagle. Thorondor, we are told, just means the king of the Lord of the Eagles. He was originally called Sarantor in the Book of Lost Tales. That's because that was his that seemed to be his name, or that eagle element in the name in Quenya rather than Sindarin. But anyway. So yes, Thorondor is the king of the eagles, and he's kind of a favorite of mine. He's a small character, but he's pretty cool. I'm a big fan of Thorondor the eagle. Let's see. Let's go on to the foundation of Gondolin. John, you want to start this off?
Yes. I wanted to first touch upon the whole foundation from the starting at Nevrast. I found it curious that Turgon, especially, would settle first by a place which is similar to Beleriand, we're told, but yet quite different in its climate. It's closer to the sea. And I wanted to touch also upon Ulmo, because, of course, we know Ulmo's involvement is quite great, as we're informed, and it seems to me as though he has some premonition of Tuor and his coming, because he tells Turgon to leave his hauberk and his helm, along with his sword, to a certain stature, if I believe. I don't know if this is exactly due to the song of the Ainur, the vision of the Ainur, or whether it's just Ulmo going on a hunch, but I'd like your input on that as well. Also, with that, in Gondolin itself, I believe you touched on this earlier in your other podcasts, how it's a replica of basically Tirion upon Túna. We have, two trees similar to Lorwyn and to Lúthien. I forget the exact names. But, I find it very funny and yet quite appropriate that basically the exiles here would try to have a piece of home here in the great lands, Middle-earth. With that, I'm sorry for ranting on here. I wish to also cover how Ulmo calls basically Turgon City, which was previously named, I believe, Andolinde. Gondolin first. I don't know whether Gondolin was a name first devised by Ulmo or not. So that is my wonderful little treatise on the history of Gondolin and its founding.
Yeah, good. That's a bunch of great things. See, this week I had the prudence actually to be taking notes for myself as you were speaking, so that I wouldn't forget to address to say half the things that your comment raised, as I usually do. First, your comment on Ulmo and his anticipation of the coming of Tuor later on. Yes, that is made very explicit later on, as you mentioned. Though it is not stated explicitly here in this version of it, we're told that Ulmo tells Turgon to leave armor and a sword behind in Vinyamar. And this is the sign by which he will know the messenger that Ulmo is going to send. Ulmo will send him a messenger, and this, you know, he will know that it is Ulmo's messenger because he's going to wear this armor that Turgon is leaving behind. And it is mentioned later that Ulmo gives him like the exact measurements, like, you know, this is the size of armor you should make. He knows exactly what Tuor, when Tuor is going to come, and you know what he looks like, and exactly what his he has very specific foresight of this, not just a rough, I think that somebody's going to come here later on. This is, I think, an interesting moment. You know, as you mentioned, John, this seems to be back to Ulmo remembering the music and being able to anticipate what's going to happen. This is one of the clearest instances, I think, that we have of the Valar plainly knowing in some detail the future before it's going to happen. Now, that's not to say that Ulmo knows absolutely everything here, and that he can, you know, that he basically has the whole book in advance prior to all of these events happening. But there are some things, at least, that he is anticipating very clearly and very directly. So I think that that's... I do think that this is an interesting moment. It's not to say, I think, I mean, I don't think that we can safely extrapolate from this to say, well, since Ulmo obviously knows about Tuor and knows exactly about Tuor, that therefore we can assume that all of the, you know, the Valar in general know all about all of the other things that are going to be happening. But it clearly does happen. We do see this kind of very specific anticipation. Jason, you wanted to add to this?
Yes, what you're just saying about this being one of the few times that the Valar have clear foresight of something that's going to happen, it seems to raise the issue, what good does it do? Because, of course, in the end, Turgon does exactly the opposite of what Ulmo's counseling him to do.
Yeah, well, exactly. And it is, a good thing to remember. And sort of to speak... not only to sort of as this scene as a piece of evidence for the power, the nature, and the limitations of the powers of the Valar, but also of their choices as well. Ulmo, on the one hand, is intervening certainly more directly than we see any of the other Valar doing here. He's taking a direct hand in guiding and protecting. I mean, he does more, it seems, than is even explicitly said. He is protecting them as they're going through. You know, that you know, we've got this migration of an entire people, and yet nobody sees any of them going. They manage to keep this mass migration a complete secret when they go and where they go to. And you know, it is suggested that it is Ulmo who protects them. His power is in the River Sirion, and as they travel through the Vale of Sirion, they, you know, and therefore and thus into the Vale, they are protected and guided. But nevertheless, although he's being very direct, although he's intervening in these ways, although he is taking a direct hand and he's guiding the establishment of Gondolin and the establishment of Nargothrond, he is not doing anything directly. And Jason, as you say, the thing he most directly does, that is his warning and guidance, ultimately is going to be disregarded. Did you want to add something else, Jason?
I guess you could argue that by planting the thought in Turgon's mind to go seek out the Vale, that he is assisting in the eventual salvation of the Noldor, whatever remains of the Noldor by the end of the story. But I did think it was interesting that, as you say, when he's most direct about warning them against a specific course of action, love not too well the work of your own hands, that's the part that gets left aside, and so whatever benefit comes out of that is more indirect, I suppose.
Yeah. No, exactly. I mean, and that I would say is actually, uneven. I mean, this sort of something that I was not exactly overlooked there, not exactly overlooking, but he's not only anticipating Tuor very specifically, he's also somewhat less concretely anticipating Eärendil. Remember that the true hope of the Noldor lieth in the west and cometh from the sea. He knows what's going to happen, it seems, and he is. So, as I said, he's not as specifically foretelling Eärendil as he is foretelling Tuor. But yeah, he seems to know the plan. I don't think that we can say, or that we're supposed to understand here, that although he sees the arrival of Tuor, you know, there's this limitation of his vision. You know, he sees the arrival of Tuor, but he doesn't see the fact that Turgon's not going to listen. I think he, you know, I don't see any reason to think that he doesn't foresee that. And yet still does what he does. Even Olmo, who is plainly not neglecting Middle-earth and plainly not abandoning it, is still not taking a really forceful hand and is still really letting them do their own thing and make their own choices. Dave, go ahead.
I have two questions. The first is, to what extent, or what is the extent of Olmo's knowledge? So what I'm wondering is, what is he actually, is he actually anticipating Tuor, or is it more sort of a limited knowledge? He knows that he's supposed to do this. He's anticipating someone. Someone will come and get it. Or does he? Do you think he specifically anticipates a specific individual? And then the second question is, what is the source of his knowledge? Is this something that all the Valar know? Is this something that Mandos whispered to him, sort of prodded him, hey, you should go do this? Or are we supposed to see the sort of... Are we supposed to see the connection between Olmo as sort of the water guy, and the connection between the water and the music being sort of the narrative of history?
Yeah, I think that we are supposed to see this as a pretty direct foreseeing. That is, with Tuor, he might perhaps not. One could say he does know specifics about who's going to come. Does that necessarily mean he knows the whole story of Tuor leading up to it? I don't know. I mean, the suggestion, I think, is yes. I mean, he knows, his height, weight, and inseam, you know? So his vision of who is to come is pretty clear. And when we get to the story of Tuor eventually, we'll see that Olmo... takes a hand in guiding Tuor specifically. I think the evidence that we have points to the fact that he does anticipate that pretty directly. As for the source of his information, we're not told that he gets it from anywhere else but himself. And he does have access to this, it seems. I mean, remember that moment with Manwë and Yavanna when they're talking about the Ents and the Eagles. Manwë does his thing where he gets back in touch with the music and sort of the vision is unfolded again in front of him and stuff. We never see Olmo doing something like that. But remember that Olmo is nearly Manwe's peer, and so the kind of vision, the kind of role that he plays, he seems to certainly be capable of doing that on his own. And because he is one of the greatest of all of the Valar, I don't think that we need necessarily assume that all of the other Valar would have exactly that same insight. But it seems that he does. And so, I think Olmo is really interesting because, you know, he's like the representative Valar here, you know, and I don't think, although we're told that he's, you know, he's kind of a loner and he doesn't hang out with the other Valar all the time and he kind of goes his own way, he is in really close friendship with Manwë, and I don't think there's any reason to think of him as actually really breaking ranks with the rest of the Valar here and doing things that they wouldn't do or don't approve of. I think that would be, it seems to me that would be kind of taking things a little too far with him. So I am more comfortable sort of seeing him as, basically he has taken on the role of being the Valar who is sort of paying attention, the one who is working on behalf of people. But again, he's not just being their advocate. He's not just helping them out. He's guiding them. He's advising them. But he's still pursuing the same general plan that Manwë pursued when Feanor was speechifying back in Valinor. That is, okay, like, this is a terrible idea, and I'm going to show up and I'm going to tell you on a couple of different occasions that this is a really, really bad idea, but you guys want to do it, we'll let you go. You guys want to, you know, start killing each other, we'll let you do that. You're not going to like what's going to happen if you do that, but, you know, okay, there you go. And, you know, in the Curse of Mandos, and then now, you know, I will warn you, but, you know, in the end, Turgon, you're going to make your own choice. So, so yeah, I think that seems to be, how Ulmo's working there. Jordan, you had a thought about Ulmo here?
Yeah, sort of the pecking order of the Valar, because at a certain point, Ulmo says to Turgon, like, you're still under the curse of Mandos, and I can't do anything about that. So, I mean, I understand them not wanting to, you know, step on the other Valar's toes, but if he really wanted to, why couldn't he lift the curse on Turgon specifically?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, and I don't think that this is a question of him not being able to. He doesn't want to. I mean, he is not breaking ranks. He is not. He has no interest in deviating from this. Remember that moment earlier before, when Tolkas, for instance, did not want to give mercy to Melkor. You know, when Melkor makes his speech, and you know, Nien is like, yes, please, and Manwë says, oh, okay, I think this will be great. There are those, including Tolkas, who don't like it and who don't agree with that choice. But they don't make any trouble, and they don't oppose it, and they don't work against it at all. And, you know, what we're told is that, you know, those who would defend authority against rebellion must not themselves rebel. They're not going to break ranks with Manwë. They're going to submit to his decision and his authority, because he's the vice regent of Iluvatar here in Arda. And I think that we can see Ulmo doing that. I mean, he's not going to be like behind, you know, I was about to say behind the backs of the other Valar, as if he's even behind their backs, but he's not going to be going around, you know, sneaking around and saying, hey, like, let's hope Manwë's not watching, and I'll like, or, you know, or Mandos, who is the doomsman of the Valar, I'm going to work against them. He's not going to work against them. I don't think that this is a situation. In one of my classes I've been doing Ovid's Metamorphoses, and one of the things that we've been talking about is the way in which the Greek and Roman gods seem unable to undo a thing that another god has done. Right, so when, for instance, Jupiter and Juno are having their dispute, and they call upon Tiresias to judge which one is right and which one is wrong, and Tiresias decides in favor of Jupiter and against Juno. Juno gets mad and strikes him blind. Jupiter, who wants to reward him, can't unblind. I mean, he can't make him see again, because Juno has made him blind, and he can't undo that. So what he does is he gives him the gift of prophecy. Like, you're going to be blind, but you're going to be a prophet too. And I don't think that that's the kind of situation that we're seeing here. I don't think that's how it works among the Valar. Like, oh, golly, I wish I could undo that. I totally disagree with what Mandos did. I think you guys are getting a bum rap, but unfortunately my hands are tied. I think this is, he's in agreement. You know, he is still, I think, although he is independent and on his own to some extent, I think he's still pretty much, you know, shoulder to shoulder with the other Valar in his actions here. That's how I take him. And so therefore, that's why I think, you know, he's sort of reminding him of the curse of Mandos, and this is how it's going to be. It's sort of in the context of his advice, you know, the shadow of Mandos lies on you. Like, you are also under Mandos's curse. Don't forget about that, because I think in part that is like a subset of his advice not to love too well the work of his own hands, right? Don't get so caught up in your little hidden wonderland of Gondolin in there, totally cut off from the rest of the world, geographically separated from everybody. you might think that you've made a little paradise here. You might think that you've achieved a kind of perfection. You might think that, you know, nothing can get to you, and that that nothing could go wrong with you. But you know what? Don't forget, it's not true. The shadow of Mandos lies on you also. So anyway, that's how I take Olmo here, and I think that it's I do think that he is to me one of the most interesting of the Valar, one of the most kind of puzzling. Everybody else, I feel like, is a little bit easier to peg. Olmo is I think really fascinating. I want to go back. See, again, this is why I'm really glad that I took notes when John was talking today, because I would totally have forgotten the other point that he made that I really wanted to get back to, which is the way in which Gondolin is made in the image of Tirion upon Tuna. And I think that this is a really interesting thing, and it's one of the things that really sets Gondolin apart from really everything else. Turgon is the one who, you know, as John, I think you said, he brings, you know, he makes like a little piece of home, right? This is the only one of the elf kingdoms which is explicitly hearkening back to Valinor. Everybody else has kind of turned their backs on Valinor, and they are, you know, they are moving forward. They are focusing on other things. And you know, even Gondolin, or sorry, not Gondolin, even Nargothrond is modeled, we're told, not after anything in Valinor, but after Menegroth. You know, he sees Thingol's realm, Finrod does, and says, "Hey, this is great. You know, I love this idea." And Thingol tells him, "Hey, you know, I think I've heard there's some pretty sweet caves there by the River Narog," and so Finrod sets it up. But here in Gondolin, and really in Gondolin alone, we see this. You know, the primary focus of Gondolin is that it is a memorial. It is a memorial of Elven Tirion, and not just a memorial, but a recreation. There's a memorial of the trees. These are not like the Silmarils in the sense that they are. You know, they don't light up. They're trees of gold and silver. They're just memorials of the trees. But Gondolin itself is at least potentially more than just a memorial of Tirion. It is a memorial, but it's also a thing which actually could and might, and in Turgon's mind, it seems eventually will rival or replace Tirion upon Tuna. So I think it's part of what Olmo is talking about. Love not too well the works of your own hands. But I think it's interesting to connect Turgon's construction of Gondolin and this kind of backward-facing, the kind of backward-facing that is back towards Valinor, facing nature of Gondolin. I think it's interesting to connect that with one of the details that we're told about Finrod. You know, Finrod and Turgon are these two that are singled out by Olmo to set up these secret realms with the desire of preserving as long as possible the Noldor race against the onslaught of Morgoth, which Olmo certainly sees coming, even if some of the others, including Fingolfin, as we discussed a couple weeks ago, don't really see coming or don't anticipate sufficiently. But anyway, so Finrod and Turgon are connected by this, by the dreams and visions that they're given by Olmo. And there's this other detail that connects them. Finrod, we were told, remember when we get the description of the making of the Nauglamir, the necklace of the dwarves that Finrod has made by the dwarves, by all the gems that he brought, not all of them, but by these gems that he brought out of Valinor. And we're told that Finrod brought more with him. He brought more treasures with him out of Valinor than any of the other of the princes of the Noldor. So it seems to be another thing that connects Finrod and Turgon, and that is both of them are the two that are sort of looking backwards. Finrod through the stuff that he brought. He brought more mementos with him, and then Turgon dedicates himself to building a big ol' memento of Valinor. And it seems not a coincidence, therefore, that it's these two guys, the two guys who are sort of most pro-Valinor, most remembering of Valinor, that these are the guys whom Olmo comes to. And so, as I said, I don't think that that's a coincidence. Dave, go ahead.
You were sort of already touching on this. I was going to ask, is the looking back thing a good thing? Because I feel like in sort of modern society, we tend to have this attitude that looking back, sort of, you know, living in the past, as it were, is a negative thing, that people should look forward, move on, that sort of thing. And certainly a lot of the other Noldor have kind of moved on, and they're focusing on, you know, Middle Earth and conquering new realms and all that. And I wonder if, is the looking back the sort of almost subconscious wistfulness for Valinor a good thing or a bad thing? Or maybe it's both good and bad. It has good and bad features.
Yeah, I do think so. That it's certainly not purely bad. I mean, I think there's no question about that. And you know, what you were bringing up first, the sort of moving forward as opposed to looking back. That's a very human perspective. That is human as opposed to elvish. And the elves, they look back a lot. They look back all the time. Remember the conversation that Gimli and Legolas have in The Lord of the Rings about memory and elven memory, and you know, Gimli saying that he has heard that for elves, memory is more like to the waking world than like to a dream. So I mean, the elves, increasingly as time goes on, memory is all they have, memory, clearly not a bad thing. Memorializing, clearly not a bad thing. It's interesting what Ulmo cautions Turgon about loving too well the work of his own hands. And we were quoting this already, you know, in anticipation back when we were talking about Feanor. And this is, I think, one obvious parallel to bring up here with Turgon, is that that phrase, love not too well the work of your own hands, we have, of course, seen the huge example of this already, which is Feanor and the Silmarils. And so, in a sense, Gondolin is like Turgon's Silmaril. And, you know, the fact that we have the tree memorials and the Tirion memorial there kind of similar to Feanor's desire to preserve the light of the trees in his gems, there was a kind of a memorial aspect to Feanor's as well. Now that too was different, because the trees weren't dead and no one was anticipating that. So it's not a look back at something that is lost, and the trees have been lost for good, and Tirion upon Túna has been lost to Turgon because he's exiled now. He's exiled by his choice to go and to follow Feanor. So therefore, and you can see sort of the direction of the memorializing is very different from Feanor's making of the Silmarils. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's good in the sense that, I mean, there has to be something about the fact that these two guys happen to be sort of the last two of the Noldor, at least, to fall, although that could be related to the fact that they went and dug themselves holes and built giant fortresses and also chose places that weren't in the immediate vicinity of Morgoth and his people. But I also wonder if there's more to it than that, that these two guys who, despite the fact that they kind of came across and followed Feanor and participated in the bad stuff and cut themselves off, they haven't really cut themselves off in their hearts, and they still long for Valinor and that connection to the Valar, and that somehow that made them worthy or made them fit, suitable for people to be sort of steered by the Valar. And then in the end, I mean, you know, they end up falling anyway, and they have tragic stories, but they're kind of rewarded in the sense that they fall last, and they have some of the best stories.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't think that there is the looking to the West from now on, certainly, is certainly in non-Noldor people, looking to the West is going to be a good thing. Well, okay, the Numenorean incident, but that's a different kind of looking to the West. Anyway, people who look to the West generally are good and generally are better, and I agree. I don't think there's a coincidence that these two, you know, backwards-looking, westward-looking people are the two that Ulmo approaches. And, of course, that's why they're hiding out, and that's why they are the two who are actually not actively... I mean, you know, one thing that's kind of interesting about them they are not really contributing to the leaguer of Morgoth. You know, the other people, you've got Thingol and Melian, who just by the nature of the Girdle of Melian are walling off this one big section. You've got Fingolfin and Fingon up in the northeast, you know, sort of taking care of that side of things from the sea over essentially to the Pass of Sirion. You've got the other sons of Finarfin up there on Dorthonion. You've got the sons of Feanor over there on the east. So they're all, and then you've got Turgon and Finrod hanging out, hiding in their hidden realms down to the south behind the main lines. Turgon, of course, is up there pretty close to the lines, but because he's so sheltered in, he's not actually taking any kind of active part in the siege. So, you know, on the one hand, it seems like they're not really exactly being team players, but remember that it's all vain. There's no point. They can't do it. They can't oppose it. And so what they are doing is, you know, Olmo tells them, you know, the wise thing for them to do. And they are protected and they are blessed because of this. Even just remembering, you know, Nargothrond is really great. It's not as great as Gondolin. Gondolin is the greatest, most beautiful, most famous of all of the dwellings of the Noldor in Middle-earth. But Finrod, you'll recall, doubtless you all recall, from last week's chapter, in the description of the geography, that Finrod ruled the largest stretch of land of any of the Noldor. He has, like, half of Beleriand under his rule. And so, I mean, again, there are these ways in which we can see both of them being blessed, not just by the fact that they're going to end up surviving longer than the rest of them, than the rest of the kingdoms of the Noldor, but we can see them being sort of blessed even, you know, sort of in more kind of temporary ways. Yeah, so in the end, I do think that looking back is a good thing. But I mean, of course, it's also a tragic thing. Don't forget that Turgon didn't really want to go. He, of all of the grandsons of Finwë, he was one of the ones who was speaking against Feanor and who was urging caution, and who was sort of the most level-headed. There were some like Fingon. I'm sort of not even counting Feanor's sons, you know, as they were all like, yes, we shall swear this insane oath with you instantaneously. But among the comparatively level-headed sons, well, children, I should say, including Galadriel, of Fingolfin and Finarfin, Turgon was one of the was singled out among them as one of the ones who was in opposition and who was not supporting Feanor. He goes along to stick with his brothers and his cousins and to help them. But he was not gung-ho about this, like some of the others among the Noldor were, including, of course, we will remember, Galadriel. Now, you know, of course, we'll come back to Galadriel later on tonight. I think it's kind of interesting to remember that, to remember Galadriel's role in the context of the conversation that we get between her and Melian later on. But let's move on to Thingol. Let's see. Jack, you wanted to talk about Thingol?
Yeah. Toward the end of the chapter, Thingol finally finds out about all of the Noldor's dirty deeds back in Valar and how they came here, why they came here. And one of his punishments is to forbid the Noldor language, which is Quenya, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so he forbids that language. And at first that just kind of seemed arbitrary and petty, but the more I thought about it, I thought maybe there's something more to it. And I have some ideas, but I wanted to get your thoughts on it.
Well, I mean, of course, it's a very Tolkien kind of punishment, right? We shall seek retribution in the harshest way we can possibly think of. We won't let you speak your language. I think that's on the one hand kind of very typical. Remember two things from earlier on that are clearly very much a part of this. One is that when the Noldor come, recall that Thingol claims absolute overlordship of all of Middle-earth, basically. He's like, okay, just keep in mind, you're in my realm now, and I don't want you taking realms away from my people. And, of course, the Noldor are saying, well, okay, look, you don't actually rule in these places because these places were overrun by orcs. So we're going to set up our kingdoms here. And, you know, why don't you kind of get over yourself, Thingol? You rule in Doriath. That's great. As I say, let's all move on. Be grateful that you have us as your neighbors instead of the orcs. So the first was his claim to overlordship. And, you know, we can see that when he makes this proclamation, you know, the Sindar will hear my voice and they will follow along with what I'm about to dictate. And they do. Right, so we can see that he does still actually have this kind of influence. However, he doesn't actually have the power to rule the Noldor. He can't give commands to the sons of Feanor. At least, I mean, he can, but they're not going to listen. Nor even are the others. Even the sons of Finarfin, who are his great nephews. They're still not ruled by him. And he doesn't seem even to try to rule them, though he has friendly relationships with them most of the time. But so he doesn't actually try to assert political authority over them. And so therefore, making this proclamation, this is the way that he can punish the Noldor. And you see, the effect of the punishing is to remove the primary distinguishing things that separates the culture of the Noldor from the culture of the Sindar, which is their language. The two of them now speak different languages because their languages have been sundered for so long. And he now is going to make Beleriand monolingual, essentially. We're told that, of course, Quenya doesn't die entirely and lives on as a language of lore. I love that expression, by the way. As a language of lore, that's what most people call dead languages, you see, but in Tolkien's world, that is the life of a language, not its death. It shall live on as a language of lore. I always love that point. Like Latin, basically, lives on throughout the Middle Ages and beyond as a language of lore. Anyhow, but by removing them, by removing that distinction, he basically sort of melds the Noldor and the Sindar closer together, and therefore, in a sense, in effect, kind of increases his own stature. He is the one who rules over the Sindar, and the Noldor, again, their perspective, hey, we'll set up our own little places and we'll rule over them, and whatever you keep ruling the Sindar, that's fine. We'll do our own thing. Well, now it's not that they're all Sindar now, but they are less distinguished. So I think as an assertion of authority and as a kind of punishment, I think it seems very effective, and I think it certainly is in many ways, I think, kind of just. It is interesting also the way in which the Noldor go along with this. But I'd love to hear other people's thoughts about this, too. Jack, did you want to go on and say some of the things you were thinking about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, everything you said seems very pragmatic and spot on, and that works for me. But I was also thinking that, you know, in Tolkien, you kind of get the idea that magic is really, really tied to language. And, you know, this was the language that Feanor used to rouse his people and do these terrible deeds. And I was just wondering if Thingol was thinking, well, there's something in Quenya that's not in Sindarin that would allow someone like Feanor to do that. I'm going out on a limb there, it's kind of stretching it, but that popped into my mind.
Well, you know, I think that's a neat point. And I don't know if it's going a bit too far or not, maybe, but you know, it's hard to forget the eloquence of Feanor and the speeches of Feanor and the way in which he was able to dominate people with his words. Even as, you know, as the sons of Finarfin say, you know, we became as besotted with wine. You know, they were made drunk by Feanor's words. And that and that was in Quenya. Now, I mean, does that mean that Quenya is a more, you know, besotting language than Sindarin? I don't think so. Does that mean that Quenya is a sort of a more evil language? No, I don't think so. But yeah, it has been. It's not just that the Noldor, the people, have done evil deeds. I think you're right to sort of remind us the Quenya language has been perverted to evil uses, especially by Feanor, and not just in his speeches, but in his oath as well, and the oath of the sons of Feanor. I definitely think that there is that there's something in that. I think that it's one of the things that makes this really a really elegant moment. The passage I'm looking for, and here it is. I just found it, where he's actually making the proclamation. What he emphasizes, what Thingol emphasizes about it, all such as use it, that is the tongue of the Noldor. I'll go back a sentence. All the Sindar shall hear my command that they shall neither speak with the tongue of the Noldor nor answer to it, and all such as use it shall be held slayers of kin and betrayers of kin unrepentant. If you repent, so notice he's not just saying to his people, this is a message directly to the Noldor. If you won't do this, I might not actually be your king. You might not actually submit to me so as to take orders from me. But I'm drawing a line in the sand right here. If you continue to use Quenya openly and are going to talk to me and my people in Quenya, then I am going to take it that you are unrepentant for slaying your kin and betraying your kin. If you want to show that you do repent of it, if you want to show that the kin slaying, you know, that was a bad thing, and that you then you're going to do this. Then you're not going to use that language anymore, which has been used and has been already kind of perverted in those ways. They take him up on it, and you know, some of them perhaps out of prudence, but nevertheless, there is clearly this is in line also with what Angrod had just been saying, that they do repent. The sons of Finarfin are innocent of the kinslaying, certainly, and their people are innocent of the kinslaying and have only suffered harm and not done it. Have suffered harm from their kin in the betrayal which leads to the crossing of the Helcaraxa. But they too repent for. You know, they are sorry for the evil that was done, so they get the opportunity to demonstrate that they're sorry for it by not speaking Quenya anymore. Yeah, Mike?
I just what I read into that was maybe here we have another couple. We have Thingol and Melian. Mm-hmm. And what I read into that was Melian only hears part of the story from Galadriel, and she sort of infers and deduces like these very profound conclusions about what she's heard and the sort of long view consequences of the bits of information she's just heard from Galadriel. And then Thingol, when he hears the whole story, you know, admits, I've lost my temper, and is forced to make a kind of, maybe not a rash decision, but a more forceful decision about what he's got to do with that information. And so I read that to be an illustration of, you know, a partial illustration of the temperaments of the two sides of this couple, and also an illustration of the fact that they are different types of beings. And maybe that's part of it, too.
Yeah. This is not the last time we're going to see Melian being much, much wiser and calmer than Thingol. Yeah, Thingol will screw up several times, and on other occasions, Melian will see it even more clearly than she does here. I do like that moment where Thingol sort of recognizes, like, okay, I'm really mad right now. You better leave. I don't want to say anything that I'm going to regret later on. You know, my heart is hot within me. But it does seem. What he does is not just done rashly, and it doesn't seem to be done unwisely, because of course one of the consequences of this also, you know, as I said, you know, to the extent that the consequence of this decree by Thingol is to bring about a closer mixture of the two people, that's a good thing. I mean, again, back to pro-Turgon comments, as we discussed last time, in Nevrast, where Turgon settles, that's where the joining of the Noldor and the Sindar had happened most and most completely, we're told. Turgon does a better job of any of the other Noldor in bringing together Noldor and Sindar, and we're even given the detail as they're on their way to Gondolin that there are more Sindar than Noldor in Gondolin, and the two of them are joined into one people, the Gondolindrim, as they will be called. And that's a good thing. So even if, and it doesn't seem, I mean, I'm not trying to say that that's Thingol's plan. He's like, I have this benevolent plan for, you know, the breaking down of barriers between the Sindar and the Noldor, but that is in fact a consequence of the decision that he makes here. Dave?
I wanted to point out that he seems to both overreact and underreact. He gets really mad and he makes this decree, and it, as you point out, it maybe has some good consequences, but I don't think he intends them. I think he's just doing it purely to punish the Noldor. And at the same time, he horribly underestimates the damage that the Sons of Feanor will be able to do. Melian goes out of her way. Of course, this is before he gets the whole picture, but she goes out of her way to warn him. These guys are trouble, and he just says, like, wow, you know, they'll be a big help in the fight against Morgoth. Well, their swords will cut both ways. I'm not too worried about it. And he just, I mean, he pays for that down the road, and not just him, but also his son. And I just think that's interesting. He really does seem to lack the wisdom that Melian has, in that he overreacts in some things, and in other cases he underestimates the damage that the Sons of Feanor can do.
Yeah, it's true. Though, you know, it's also kind of hard to think, what would he have done differently there? That is, what would being even more cautious of the Sons of Feanor look like? As it is, he has no contact with them. He doesn't trust them. He doesn't bring them in to do anything. He doesn't do anything with them. So, in practical terms, I'm not quite sure what distrusting them further would actually look like on the ground. But I agree. He certainly, that is, I think, a really classic illustration. Here, as I said, we'll see more later, but that's a really classic illustration here of what it means that he has less wisdom than Melian. That his thought is, you know, hey, well, awesome, at least they're not going to ally themselves with Morgoth and betray us, ha ha ha. Not exactly. But of course, the Sons of Feanor are going to ultimately be the enemies of Doriath.
Does anyone ever report to him the full contents of the oath of Feanor and his sons? I'm not sure if Angrod reports that to him, because now maybe it wouldn't have made a difference. Maybe he really believed that he was safe behind the Girdle of Melian, but you would think that maybe he would have thought twice about later decisions,
yeah.
Not to spoil it for anyone, if he had heard the full contents of the oath, where they go on about, you know, doesn't matter who's got it, if it's a Valar or Morgoth or an orc or an elf or anyone that's got one of those things, we're coming after you. And so you would think that maybe he would have had a slightly different perspective on everything if he had that in mind. But, you know, maybe not. Maybe he was that arrogant and that short-sighted that he didn't care. That's popped into my mind.
Yeah, no, I do agree with that. And I agree that in, as you say, later decisions, I think the evidence later on is that he does seem to know about the oath. So I think either he finds it out here or he learns it in other ways. I'm pretty sure by the time Thingol gets to the point of making Silmaril-related decisions, he's aware of the oath. But I agree. At the very least, it's kind of interesting that doesn't seem to be a factor here. I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, it's kind of understandable that his focus is on the kinslaying. I mean, the Teleri, it's not just his own brother or something. I mean, these were his people. I mean, he was the lord of these people before he, you know, got kind of distracted on the way over. So I you know, as I said, it makes perfect sense. No criticism of Thingol that's what his focus is. And obviously that's a horrible thing. And sort of secondarily, he points to the betrayal of the children of Fingolfin and Finarfin. You know, when he talks about the breach among the Noldor, which has only been not fully healed, even though sort of bridged over. But I do agree that it is kind of interesting that the oath doesn't come up here, because you'd think, as if he's listing reasons why he's really upset at the Noldor and really disapproves of them, you'd think that also pretty high on the list would be, oh yeah, and the sons of Fëanor have sworn this like hideously blasphemous oath, that by itself, even without the kinslaying and without the burning of the ships, would still amount to very sufficient reason for him to disapprove of them and to be extremely leery of them and even desire to punish them, as he does go on to punish them. I think that certainly seems to be, as I say, interesting that doesn't come up here, and doesn't come up later perhaps as often as it should, that is, for Thingol. Now, John, you were talking about Círdan, and Dave was also interested in talking about Círdan's wisdom here. Did you have specific suggestions about Círdan, John?
Yes, I wanted to actually bring up, I think, I'm not positive, but I believe Thingol received a lot of the information regarding the Noldor from Círdan. I think there's a brief passage between the final conversation between Thingol and Melian, and finally when he meets with Finrod Felagund and Engoroth, that he had some contact with Círdan. I mean, Círdan is one of these characters who we meet at the tail end, I believe, of The Return of the King, and we have several mentions of him throughout the Silmarillion, and yet he has to be, as you've pointed out earlier, I believe, in your podcast and your class, one of the oldest characters we meet in Lorien. I mean, we hardly see him at all. I think he has like something like two or three lines. But I found it very interesting. You know, what would it really been like to see things from Círdan's point of view? And I know it's related and yet unrelated to what we're talking about, but I believe it holds true to the way Thingol is receiving, you know, this news. Thingol is basically Lord of the Sindal, and basically was, as you pointed out earlier, of the, you know, Teleri people. And he's of the Teleri. And Círdan is by the seashore, and he's definitely, for sure, I don't know, I forget if he was a Teleri or not, but he seems pretty closely in line with that people, you know, a Teleri of Middle Earth. And his whole reaction, I can see, to basically the kinslaying, especially at Al-Qulwande, would be very, very negative towards the Noldor. I mean, I can obviously guess that. I think Círdan would be a pretty wise guy to tell, you know, hopefully, fact from the lies which are being spread abroad. And it seems like there are some lies. I don't know how distorted the news is by the time it reaches Thingol, but I can imagine that, you know, Morgoth has played off of this. I believe this is mentioned in the text itself. But, you know, if we're to take into account the source of the information and its felicity, you know, regards to the way Thingol is reacting to this, I think it's important to realize that there is a middleman and he has very key and intimate role.
Yeah. No, I do agree with you, and I certainly agree. Círdan is such an interesting character, who gets so little said about him, both here and in the Lord of the Rings. But I mean, the passage, as you mentioned, it's a very short passage. In fact, we can read the whole thing because it's two sentences. And Círdan, hearing these dark tales, was troubled, for he was wise, and perceived swiftly that, true or false, they were put about at this time through malice, though the malice, he deemed, was that of the princes of the Noldor, because of the jealousy of their houses. Therefore, he sent messengers to Thingol to tell all that he had heard. And what he has heard, clearly, is about the kinslaying, because it is after Círdan's messengers arrive in Menegroth that Thingol has his angry confrontation with the sons of Finarfin. Now, I think here, you know, Círdan is wise, we are told. And I think actually between this and what we saw from Melian just on this same page, we can begin to see almost like a definition of wisdom, or rather, you know, sort of this trend. Here is what it is to be wise. Here is what wise people do and say. And that is, you know, the ability to see the consequences of things, the ability to put things into the big picture, not just to get carried away with the individual things. That is like, oh, I've heard this shocking stuff about the Noldor. Oh, my goodness. Like, I'm now going to spread. I believe this implicitly, and I'm going to spread this around. Círdan looking at the bigger picture and saying, okay, there's clearly malice involved here. Therefore, we should be careful. Not just we should pay attention to what's going on, because he does, in fact, you know, take part in the spreading of this stuff around in reporting it to Thingol, but he's not just believing it and spreading it around. He's recognizing this is a problem. Not just these incidents like the kinslaying that are being reported, not only are they a problem and not only are they concerning, but the fact that these rumors are going around right now is a problem and shows that there is malice in the land. And we got to be really careful. That is wisdom, just as Melian's, you know, response, their swords and their councils shall have two edges. That also is wisdom. Don't just be too quick to say, okay, you know, like Feanor and his sons are these unpredictable entities, and they're clearly untrustworthy and dangerous. But, you know, they really hate Morgoth, so that's pretty cool. So at least we've got these dangerous people hating Morgoth near us, so that's all to the good. No, not all to the good, as Melian sees. But I think, of course, the interesting thing here about Círdan is not just that he is wise enough to see that there is malice afoot, but that he doesn't see where the malice is. He doesn't realize that this is Morgoth. And he thinks that the malice is the malice of the princes of the Noldor. And I think it's really interesting there to think, to think about that a little bit. What exactly is Círdan thinking here? What's Círdan's theory? His theory is that some of the Noldor are spreading these rumors maliciously, with malicious intentions against others of the Noldor? I guess, therefore, he's suggesting or believing that these rumors are being spread by who? By the people of Fingolfin and Finarfin in malice against the sons of Feanor? Like, we're gonna like out them on the kinslaying in order to get them in trouble with their Sindar neighbors, you know, and Thingol? Is that what he thinks? Or is it the malice of the sons of Feanor, who are obviously malicious, and one would suspect them of malice? But if so, what does he think their plan is? Mike, what do you think?
I wanted to just go back to your point about intent, and I thought that was a great point. I circled that in my text as well. I think that's key to the wiser characters in all the stories, is that they're always curious about the intent behind actions. And I was reminded of Ilúvatar exploring the intent behind Aule's creation of the dwarves. So I just saw that connection there. But I think you've laid out the two possible ideas that Círdan might have in his head in terms of what these rumors might be and who might be putting them out there.
Yeah, but neither one of them really makes all that much sense. And what I think is most interesting about it is if Círdan, whichever of those two things Círdan is convinced of, what does that suggest about how he views the Noldor? Because I think you would have to have a relatively low opinion of them in order to believe either one of those two things. I don't know, I mean, maybe I'm not being fair there, but again, I think it's pretty suggestive. Oh, and just to clarify and answer, John, some of the questions that you were asking, yes, Círdan is one of the Teleri. As we may recall from what is now quite a long time ago, our discussion of the early chapters, when the Teleri came west, last of everyone else, The Vanyar and the Noldor had already departed for Valinor, and they dwelt in Beleriand and on the shores of the sea for a long time. And remember, they became friends with Ase and really enjoyed it there. But eventually, they decided to go on, and you know, many of the Teleri went, but some who chose to stay behind, living there by the sea and being friends with Ase as they always had. And Círdan was the chief of those Teleri who chose not to go. Not the ones who stayed behind looking for Thingol. That was a different subset of the Sindar who didn't leave. But this is the Falothrim, the elves of the coast, the elves of the havens and the harbors, the ones who chose their friendship with Ase and their love for Beleriand over the trip, the final leg of the trip to Valinor. So that's where sort of Círdan comes from. But anyway, Dave, back to the bigger question.
Is there any possibility of reading this as sort of a tongue-in-cheek thing? Because to me, I think you're getting at something, saying like there's really only a couple of explanations and neither of them makes terribly much sense. And really, in the end, however wise Círdan might be, he serves Morgoth's purpose. He furthers along the purpose of Morgoth. I mean, that's something that we hadn't mentioned yet. Okay, where the heck is it? Let's see. Something about... yes, there we go. But the Sindar were yet unwary and trustful of words, and, as may well be thought, Morgoth chose them for this first assault of his malice, for they knew him not. First of all, I think it's very interesting that they describe Morgoth spreading lies and trying to sow discord through the use of lies as an assault. I think that's a very interesting description. But getting back to Círdan, you know, like however wise he might have been, however discerning he might have been about the malice and the lies, and however measured his response might have been, well, I'm going to gather this up and tell Thingol because he should probably know what's going on out there. In the end, Morgoth comes out on top of all of this. And so maybe there's a possibility of reading this as tongue-in-cheek. You know, yeah, Círdan, he was a pretty wise guy, you know, gathering up all these stories and sending them over to Thingol, because in the end, he wasn't wise enough to really see what was going on.
Yeah, yeah. Though, you know, okay, here's a defense of Círdan and his wisdom on those grounds. Manwë lacked the same kind of wisdom, it seemed. That is, he didn't know Morgoth, or rather, he did not fully appreciate the depth and completeness of the change in Melkor's heart, we're told. He believed that he could, in fact, amend. And it turns out that, no, he isn't going to amend. And the implication is, you know, basically has already gone too far to amend, has set himself against amendment, and that Manwë doesn't understand that. And so Círdan is sort of parallel to Manwë there, which is no, you know, could be worse. But I think when we talk about them not knowing Morgoth here, they don't know how he operates. This is the one thing that I always try to remind myself in this passage, because it seems so dumb for the Teleri not to think of that. Like, okay, gosh, things are being spread around like that were caused dissension among the elves. And even Círdan's like, and boy, this is clearly malicious talk. Who could be maliciously spreading stories that would sow dissension among the enemies of Morgoth? I can't think of anybody other than, I guess, maybe the Noldor. It seems like, come on, I mean, this is not even putting two and two together. It's like putting one and one together, right? Or just like, but they don't know Morgoth. They don't know that he does this kind of thing. They don't know what he's like. To them, he's just the enemy. The Sindar, remember, have had no interactions with him at all. The only two ways they have ever encountered Morgoth at all is, first, by the shores of Cui Vienin, when he was there as like the dark rider that would capture some of them and turn them into orcs. So like the fearful legends of the earliest days, that's memory number one. And memory number two is that he's the dude who sends these armies of orcs down, which slaughter as many people as they can. So they've seen him act as warlord. but they have not had that whole, you know, serpent in the Garden of Eden experience with them that the Noldor have had over there in Valinor when he is with them and he is flattering them and he is manipulating them and sowing lies. They don't know that he works this way. They don't know that he operates this way. And they seem to vastly underestimate. And of course, and they may also well assume, like the Noldor assume, that he's pretty well penned up. That Morgoth is pretty well penned up. That he's not going to be able to spread lies like this. And again, they are underestimating him because they don't know. Chris, go ahead.
I'll stick up for Círdan just a little bit. Yeah, he's heard all of these rumors, and yes, by passing it along, maybe he's furthering the spreading of the rumors, but Thingol is his lord, and it would seem to me that it was his duty to kind of, you know, keep him informed. These are the things I'm hearing, so I think it's maybe not quite fair to say that he shouldn't have been reporting this to Thingol. Just an observation.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, I don't think he's certainly not just rumor mongering here. In fact, by telling Thingol he's doing the thing that he most sensibly and best can in order to stop them. Because Thingol's the one who's in a position to say, like, okay, people, you know, let's think about this, let's take a look at these things, and let's stop doing this. I agree. I don't think that his sending this message on to Thingol is itself like a wicked act or a corrupt act. Though again, I don't think that Dave's wrong to say that. It is still his report that brings about the confrontation. And the moment of division between the elves is actually brought to pass by the thing that Círdan does. Again, not with malicious intent, and I don't think there's anything sketchy in his decision to report it to Thingol, but nevertheless, it is the thing. This is still the goal that Morgoth had in mind the whole time, was to create this division,
right,
and this resentment that is created. But then, of course, trumping even that, as usual, is that, nevertheless, good is going to come from this as well. It's a win in the end. I do agree with your qualification there, that I don't think that this is a reprehensible act by Círdan or something.
I can't see that he would have done anything else that he would. I mean, just as you'd report what would be possible intelligence or just additional facts to your boss, that just seems like that would it wouldn't have been a good decision. He wouldn't know the further ramifications, but seem to me the only decision he could make.
I do definitely agree with that. Dave, you had wanted to talk before about sort of comparing and contrasting Gondolin and Nargothrond with Doriath. I think that sounds like an excellent idea. So do you want to start that one off?
Sure. I don't have too many deep thoughts to offer about it. I think that's sort of a natural direction to take the conversation, because those are kind of the three strongholds, right? There really aren't any other strongholds in Middle Earth at this time.
You've got the kingdoms
kind
that
of a,
form the
a chapter in each book, there's a chapter for each of these places essentially describing its downfall. I just think it'd be an interesting conversation. How are they alike? How are they different in how they were founded? And what is the nature of their sort of their protectedness and how they eventually came apart and the nature of their rulers and stuff? But I haven't put much thought into it. I just think it's interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Does anyone have any thoughts? Anything you'd like to point out? Yeah, Mike, go ahead.
The ball rolling, and I will say that Doriath, when Melian's quote-unquote magic is in operation, I think is the sort of the best protected stronghold because of that quote-unquote magic. But Gondolin is more spectacularly beautiful and idealized. That would be my first two observations.
Yeah, yeah. You know, though you can say in one sense that all three of them have protection, I'm tempted to use the word supernatural, which is always a kind of an awkward word to use in Tolkien's fiction, but still, they all have, to some extent, supernatural protection. Melian, of course, most obviously and most openly, with her girdle of protection. But remember that both Gondolin and Nargothrond are also protected by Olmo. You've got the explicit references to Olmo's guarding and concealment of the approach to Gondolin. But also with Nargothrond, the way that it's protected by the River Narag. Recall the bit we haven't read yet. When things go bad for Nargothrond, the sort of the centerpiece of what is going to open Nargothrond to destruction is the building of a bridge over the River Narag. When they are no longer basically submitting themselves to the protection of the river and therefore Olmo through it, then that's when things are going to go wrong. Now, there's clearly a much more direct protection of Doriath than there is almost a little bit, you know, much more behind the scenes than Melian is there. But they all have a measure of that protection. I say, Jack, you just made an interesting point, which I actually think is well worth raising. Do you want to mention? I just saw you said something in the text over there that I think is interesting.
Yeah, I was being facetious when I said that Gondolin was unsullied by dwarven hands, but when I did read it, I did note that this was all made by elves, and I was thinking of the place in Doriath. What's it called?
Menegroth.
Menegroth, where they brought in the dwarves to help create it. But Gondolin, it was all elfish design.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I do think that that's interesting. And it's one of the reasons why, well, I don't know, it's one of the reasons why, but it is certainly significant. Gondolin is like the elvish place. It's like the most elvish place in Beleriand. And I do think it's an interesting kind of trend. I agree with you, sort of joking about in the use of the word unsullied by dwarven hands, because it doesn't seem to be a bad thing, really. But it's true. Menegroth was built in large part by the dwarves, and Nargothrond was established first in the site of a place which had originally been built by dwarves, and then we know that Finrod enlisted the assistance of the dwarves. We see both of those two things, the dwarves contributing, but Gondolin is sort of, okay, I'm tempted to use the word pure, but again, that seems unnecessarily pejorative towards the dwarves, but certainly isolated. It is only elvish, you know, and we will get, there will only ever be two non-elves who will ever go into or see Gondolin. That is, you know, before all the dragons and Balrogs come in, and orcs. But prior to that, there are only two non-elves who will ever go in there. And again, I think it's like the little, not only does it look back and remember Valinor, it becomes like this little mini Valinor, this little mini guarded realm, this little mini elven home. And that certainly is, I think, an essential part of the story of Gondolin and what Gondolin sort of stands for and how it functions. Whereas Doriath is like the fortress of the Sindar. It's the last realm, you know, where we find, where the Noldor find it when they come over to Beleriand is you've got Doriath is like this island and the rest of the place is overrun with orcs. They've conquered almost everything. Círdan is under siege. His cities haven't been taken, but his lands have been overrun. So you have, but Doriath is still, you know, it's like the last bit of old Beleriand, the last bit of how things were before the sun rose, before the moon rose, before the Noldor returned, before Morgoth came back. It's like the last bit of the old days in Middle-earth. And Nargothrond, well, you know, on one level also, Nargothrond is much less well-developed. Even to the fact that it's, we don't get even the same kind of physical description. We're told some of the details of Menegroth, for instance, even just its name, the Thousand Caves, is pretty evocative. And you know, we're given descriptions of, you know, the stone pillars within it that are carved to look like the, you know, the branch, the branches of trees and all those things. And of course, with Gondolin, we get some descriptions of what that city looks like and its staggering beauty. Nargothrond is, it's a bunch of caves, and it's kind of made to look like Menegroth, but we don't really know that much about it in detail. I find it harder to talk about Nargothrond than the other two. Mike, go ahead. Yeah, Mike, did you have something you wanted to add? Nope. Okay. All right. Okay. Let's see. Laura, you're back. Would you like another shot?
Well, I have no idea what you said for about the last, I don't know, 10 minutes. So I have no idea if you covered it or not, but I was just going to say that Gondolin wasn't that built to resemble Tirion?
Yes.
The city of Tirion, the White City. So and Nargothrond was just basically built as a hiding place. So that's another difference, especially between Doriath, which is, I get the impression, more of a natural realm. And I always picture it sort of like the in The Hobbit when we come across the Mirkwood elves.
Yes.
I sort of picture it and picture the people more like that. But Gondolin seems more like a civilized place, I guess I'm trying to say, you know, mm-hmm. trying to bring back the civilization that existed in Valinor.
Yeah.
But the other thing I've always wondered is, how did Gondolin stay hidden when it was visible from the air? Didn't Morgoth have, you know, crows that he would send out spying the land?
Nope.
Or is there something I've missed on that?
No, he doesn't.
I guess not.
He doesn't. He doesn't. And if he ever does suborn any birds, the eagles will, you know, beat the stuffing out of him. The eagles protect
him.
Yeah. And they, you know, they make their eyries in the Chrysagrim, in the mountains around Gondolin. And of course, since Balrogs obviously can't fly, they can't see into Gondolin. I mean, and it's one of the most obvious illustrations of the fact that Morgoth plainly does not have any air power, because the only reason you would not find Gondolin is if you don't have any air power, and you never fly, and none of your servants ever fly. And if he does get birds who work for him, yeah, they don't make it back alive from the Chrysagrim. So there it is. But yes, no crows, none that return.
You'd think you'd wonder what happened to all those birds that went that way, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's a dangerous country. You know, maybe like Shelob and her siblings caught them. You know, also possible. They live around there too. Actually, you know, one other point that I wanted to make Laura, you're making me think of that with your reminders about the connection between Gondolin and Tirion there. And this was actually referring back to a comment that Jason made in the text chat, sort of jokingly a little while back, when I was making the connection between Finrod and Turgon as the two of the Noldor chieftains who look back towards Valinor most. And Jason was joking about Finrod's other big reason for looking back towards Valinor, which is his girlfriend that he left behind. And that is, of course, funny, but I think it's really true. I think it's actually a really important thing. And this is where we end this chapter, which I think it sort of shows that it's kind of significant. What we learn here about Finrod, and I think we see a really crucial thing about Finrod. Turgon is, both of them actually also are wifeless, though for different reasons. Turgon, we will learn in the next chapter, is wifeless because his wife died during the crossing of the Helcaraxa. Finrod is wifeless because his girlfriend or fiance or whoever was left behind in Valinor and didn't come with them because she was one of the Vanyar. But I think, therefore, one of the things that this establishes about Finrod is Finrod is not at home in Middle-earth. He has left part of his heart back in Valinor. He is never going to have a family. He's never going to have children. He's never going to establish a line here in Middle-earth. And it's not just because he, as he says, he foresees the downfall of Nargothrond and realizes I'm not going to have a realm to give to a son. What on earth difference is it going to make? But it's not just that. He never really fits in here. And so that, I think, actually makes for an interesting kind of contrast with between Turgon and Finrod. Finrod is a kind of wayfarer here in Middle-earth. He has the biggest kingdom, but he's not at home here. He doesn't have both of his feet in Middle-earth. Turgon does, and he's still looking back. He's looking back really hard. But what he's doing is making a second version in homage to the other and in memory of it and thinking about it a lot and clearly with respect to the Valar and everything else. But yet he builds a home, a real home. Gondolin is going to be his place. Memory of Tirion, but it's going to be his place. And that's why he's the one. Notice Finrod isn't told by Ulmo, love not too well the works of your own hands. He's not in any threat of loving Nargothrond so much that he can't give it up. In fact, what he tells us, the foreboding that he has at the end of this chapter is, I'm going to give it up. The time's going to come when I'm getting ready to give it up. Pretty soon I'm going to be giving up this and I know that I need to be prepared. And he's going to. We will see him do what Turgon certainly is not going to be able to do, or certainly going to have a heck of a lot of a harder time doing. Love not too well the work of your own hands. Finrod's got that covered already. He doesn't need that memo. Laura?
Well, the interesting thing about Turgon, everything, and here's a big spoiler here, in case you didn't know, Gondolin is completely destroyed too, but from Turgon's son, Tuor, we end up with Arendil. So,
yeah.
You can't foresee all ends, I guess.
Yep. No, I mean, Gondolin is going to have a role to play. Gondolin and the Gondolindrum are going to have a role to play, and it is true that ultimately, salvation is going to come, indirectly, through, in as much as Arendil is the vehicle or the, stimulus, the prompting, of the salvation that's going to come, Gondolin is the one that's going to play the chief role in that, and not Nargothrond. Nargothrond, in the end, is not going to have that kind of heritage, that kind of lasting effect, that kind of lasting monument, and Gondolin will. So, yeah, it's not to say that, Finrod is doing it completely right and Turgon is not. Again, I don't think what Turgon is doing is bad, but it does show, I think, a different kind, a different quality of looking back on Finrod's part than on Turgon's. Go ahead, Laura.
Yeah, and Dave just pointed out to me, Tuor is not Turgon's son. He's his son-in-law.
Yeah, son-in-law. Sure, right. No, it is through Turgon's house. I mean, Arendil is, still Turgon's grandson. So, yeah. No, I knew where you were going with that. We should get to Galadriel and the scurrilous accusations that Dave has been longing to level against Galadriel this whole time. So, Dave, do you want to come out in the open with your anti-Galadriel sentiments here?
Yes, I sure do. And also, I have to, since Matt had to leave, I have to integrate his comments with mine.
Mostly, he and I were both struck by the fact that Galadriel kind of pulls what was known for you Seinfeld fans out there. Galadriel pulls what was known on Seinfeld as the yada yada yada, where you tell a story and you kind of leave out the unpleasant details in the middle that you'd rather not recount to your listening audience, and you just kind of skip over it and you're like, well, you know, yeah, we were over there and Morgoth did some really horrible things, killed Finwë, stole the Silmarils, and well, yada yada yada. Here we are, we're over here, and we're fighting for revenge, and we came over of our own accord. We weren't kicked out or anything. No big deal. And Melian's like, sure. I think it's very interesting. The Galadriel that we see in the Silmarillion is quite different in character from the Galadriel that we see in Lord of the Rings. I think that actually goes for elves in general. Elves in the Lord of the Rings appear to be sort of high and lofty and kind of elevated above men. And in the Silmarillion, we see elves are pretty much about as petty and capable of screwing up as men are.
Yeah. Laura, go ahead.
Dave, I can't believe you just called Galadriel petty. Well, the way I read it was that she was trying to be circumspect. She, you know, because she was on the wronged end of what Feanor did. So she was trying not to bring accusations against her fellow Noldor. You know, for whatever reason, maybe she didn't want to be the one to bring that up. So I didn't see it as her being petty so much as her just being trying to be circumspect, trying not to lay blame on others.
Well, I wasn't really so much saying she was petty as just the picture of the elves in the Silmarillion is not one of people who really got it all figured out and have the right perspective on the world and are clearly oriented against evil and doing the right thing and making the right decisions. And that's kind of of course, you know, in the Lord of the Rings, we're seeing the hobbits' perception of elves, but Galadriel in particular, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's similar to the other Noldor who, the House of Finarfin who are visiting Thingol, who are like, you know, we would really rather not be painted with the same brush as the sons of Feanor, but we also don't want to speak ill of the other Noldor, especially because we know what they'll say about us if we do. Nevertheless, I don't know, there's just something about her responses to Melian here that are very, you know, it doesn't paint a good picture of her. She doesn't come off looking too good at this point. She looks very elusive and dishonest, and it looks like she's covering this up, and I don't know, it's a very different kind of Galadriel.
And later. Well, there is one thing, and I've thought this too, reading the Silmarillion. This is the youth of the elves. They're basically, you know, you could almost call it their adolescence. By the time we're reaching the Lord of the Rings, I mean, obviously it's, you know, 7,000 years later, they've passed their adolescence. They're in their decline almost. So they have a lot more wisdom at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree with that. And also add, don't forget the shift in perspective, that is the shift in narrative viewpoint between the Silmarillion and the Lord of the Rings too. One of the reasons that the elves look so much loftier and so much further above the, you know, sort of petty concerns and temptations and shortcomings of mortals is that it's told from the mortal perspective. So especially it's told from the hobbit perspective. So, you know, if you're not only a mortal creature who's only, you know, a few dozen years old, and you're looking up at, you know, from about 2.5 to 3 feet above the ground at these elves, you're not going to see this stuff. And that's the perspective that we get in the Lord of the Rings. Whereas here, this is an in-house discussion by the elves. They know full well. And also, I think the effect that Laura has, they're not as wise then as they have come to be. There's been a whole lot more water under the bridge. You could say, I mean, they've been around for a long time. They might be chronologically, more than halfway between the, you know, the awakening by Kuivienin and the end of the Third Age. The beginning of the First Age is who even knows exactly how long. But nevertheless, a lot happens during that time. There's a whole lot of tragedy and a whole lot of suffering and a whole lot of learning and increasing in wisdom that's going to happen between then. And Laura's absolutely right about the fading time and stuff. So clearly we do have the elves as a whole are in a different place. And certainly the elves who are the survivors of the First Age, the Nold, I almost mentioned Glorfindel, and he's of course only a survivor in a rather peculiar sense. The non-survivors like Glorfindel, the repeat customers. But anyway, I say repeat customers as if there are many of them. But anyway, no, clearly they have also changed, as well as the perspective of the narrative changing. But we can't underestimate the importance, the effect of that change in the perspective on the narrative. Let's see, Chris, you wanted to contribute to this directly here?
Yeah, just a little bit here. I guess I had always envisioned when I read this part about Galadriel, I envision her sitting and squirming in her chair uncomfortably as she's being questioned by Melian. And actually, when you look at it, she doesn't deny the guesses that Melian makes about, you know, Melian's not quite on the money, but she makes a lot of pretty shrewd guesses. And Galadriel doesn't really deny any of it. She just says, you're not going to hear the details from me. So I thought that was kind of an interesting point. You know, she's I envision her being very uncomfortable in that spot. But anyway, just thought I'd throw that out there.
Yes. You know, and that moment in particular, Chris, when Melian is saying, for what cause, Galadriel, were the high people of the Noldor driven forth as exiles from Aman? Or what evil lies on the sons of Feanor that they are so haughty and so fell? Do I not strike near the truth? Near, said Galadriel. And when I hear this, when I hear Galadriel say near, what I always want her to say next is, but not in the gold. Because, of course, that is what Frodo says during the almost exactly parallel scene when Frodo is talking to Faramir in the Two Towers, and he is being pressed to reveal something he is not comfortable revealing. And mm-hmm. Faramir asks him, do I not strike near? And Frodo says, yes, near, but not exactly right. Again, I don't want to make too much of that parallel, of course, that this is not the same situation, although the one thing that I think is parallel about it is that you have two people who are not who are neither one of them actively deceiving each other, neither one of them are acting with malicious intentions, but yet there is a lack of openness between the two of them. Now, you can say Frodo has an unequivocally noble reason for doing this, that he is being prudent, he is being wise. He knows he's not supposed to just blab about the ring and blab about their quest to anybody that he meets, and he doesn't really know who this guy is. But Galadriel... So here, Laura, here's my defense of Galadriel to assist in your argument against Dave. The Galadriel's yada, 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 that is the stuff that she leaves out, is not just the stuff that looks bad. In fact, we're told that she leaves out three things. But still she said no word of the oath, nor of the kinslaying, nor of the burning of the ships at Lothgar. And the third one is the one that I think really sticks out. Like, okay, yes, like the oath... that would look bad for the Sons of Feanor, the kinslaying. Oh, okay, there are some pretty obvious reasons why we don't really want to go there. But nor of the burning of the ships at Lothgar. She was a victim of the burning of the ships at Lothgar. That is almost self-sacrificial. I mean, this is what this is like the position that Angrod reacts to later on, what he feels so frustrated by. You know, like, I've not talked about this out of loyalty specifically to the Sons of Feanor. I could have been bad-mouthing them the whole time, you know, with a kinslaying, but at least with the burning of the ships, that is something. There's no motivation to conceal that. concealing the oath is a good reason to conceal the oath. She's going to conceal the oath because she doesn't want them to, if she tells them about the oath, then this is prompting Thingol and Melian to be thinking, okay, these Noldor can't be trusted. Certainly the Sons of Feanor, they're like, they've taken this blasphemous pact that makes me real uncomfortable having them as neighbors. That's going to create direct trouble between them, potentially. The kinslaying, whatever, enough said. I mean, that's really direct trouble, not only with the Sons of Feanor, but also with some of the people of the Sons of Fingolfin, who we're told are not innocent of the kinslaying, who come and pitch in when they arrive and find the battle already joined. But the burning of the ships, that has nothing to do with Thingol. That has no implications for Thingol, other than, again, saying you can't really trust the Sons of Feanor, but he'd already, even Thingol had already tumbled to that one. But anyway, I mean, you could very plausibly tell that one in order to build confidence in the Noldor. That is, at least in most of them, right? Hey, but don't worry, you can totally trust, Fingolfin and his people, because, like, look what we did. Look what we suffered, and we forgave it, right? So if we have forgiven the Sons of Feanor after what they did to us, then, surely we are an example to you, Thingol, right? So this is a motivation for union. And yet she's not even willing to do that, because in order to do that, you still have to throw the Sons of Feanor under the bus, and she won't do it. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Yeah, Dusty brings up a good point. What if Melian asked where they got the ships that they burned? I guess it is a little bit hard to tell the whole story of the burning of the ships at Lothgar without any reference to the kinslaying and all. You don't have to mention necessarily that they were swan ships, ships. In a certain unnamed and insignificant group of ships that were burned. That is a very fair point, Dusty. Laura, you wanted to add something a minute ago?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, all those things she'd be talking about, she wouldn't really be talking about herself with any of that. She'd be talking about other people, kind of like the opposite of what we were criticizing Círdan for spreading these rumors. She doesn't want to bring up some of this stuff, I think, because it's not her. I think she'd be willing to talk about something that she did, but when, all she can say is, oh, look what so-and-so did, or these guys did that, or these, she's talking about other people, and maybe that's why she doesn't want to bring it up.
Yeah, and I think it's not just, like, sort of pure and blind solidarity. And I think her last line is, it's sort of hard to understand. Maybe, said Galadriel. But that is, Melian has just said, a darkness you would cast over the long road from Tirion. But I see evil there, which Thingol should learn for his guidance. Maybe, said Galadriel, but not of me. Maybe he should learn it, but he ain't going to learn it from me. And that's, I'm almost tempted to wonder to what extent, that sort of part prophecy as well. But I do think, getting back, the thing that I will say in defense of Dave's observation about Galadriel being different, Galadriel is my primary candidate for people that you can see who have increased in wisdom, elves that you can see who have increased in wisdom since the First Age. And she clearly has. This is the second real role that we see Galadriel playing. The second time we see her really involved in the narrative, the first time is when she wants to go. She is like one of the big Feanor supporters. Not that she's in his camp, not that she really likes him and approves of him, but when Feanor is making his recruitment speech, hey, let's leave Valinor, let's go back to Middle-earth, and let's establish kingdoms, and we won't let the men take it over, and this will be awesome. She is one of the people who is most gung-ho about that, and whose own desires resonate with Feanor's desires to rule a kingdom after her own will. But I think it's also really interesting. We don't see her do that. Of everybody who gets a kingdom, she doesn't get one. And I don't think this is just like, well, she's a girl, she doesn't get a kingdom. I don't think that that's necessarily the problem here. She stays first with Melian and Thingol, and then with Finrod, we're told, in Nargothrond for a while after that. I think she could go and set up a kingdom if she wants to, but she doesn't. Instead, she is engaged in this like long apprenticeship under Melian, it seems. And that seems potentially to be one of the reasons that she doesn't want it to be from her, that they learn this. Dave, go ahead.
That's a very interesting point. I think I'm willing to buy that she started learning her lesson on the way over, and that her time spent in Doriath under the tutelage of Melian did her some good. You know, it's very interesting that she spends all this time with Melian, the power or the force behind Doriath, and the sort of protective power, which is a role that she herself goes on to play later on in The Lord of the Rings. And she has much the same role in Lothlorien that Melian has in Doriath.
Oh, yeah, totally. No, I mean, she's going to be like the mini Melian in the Third Age. Even in looking, as you say, at the sort of the dynamics of her relationship with Celeborn, whom she meets here, of course, this is the other thing that's going on. Celeborn is a kinsman of Thingol, so this is where she and Celeborn get together. But just as Thingol and Melian, Thingol, you know, I mean, he's awesome and everything, but you know, his wife is a goddess, and so I mean, she is the one who clearly has the greater power, although, you know, Thingol is genuinely ruling. That is, he actually makes decisions, even though he is obviously not the most powerful member of that marriage. But a similar thing is definitely true of Galadriel and Celeborn. That is, she is obviously, just as obviously, above Celeborn. Though it's less obvious that Celeborn actually makes the decisions, like Thingol clearly does make the decisions. We don't really see Celeborn making all that many decisions in The Lord of the Rings, and people will just talk about Galadriel and her will and her desire. But anyway, no, that parallel is clear. And you think of that speech right after Frodo offers the ring to Galadriel, and she speaks about perceiving the mind of Sauron, and yet her mind is shut, and she does that thing where she holds up her hands in that gesture of defiance, you know, like she is from a distance stonewalling Sauron with her will. And you know, so you have, and the, you know, the land of Lothlorien is protected by more than just the slender arrows of elven bows. There is a kind of, you know, it's not exactly like the Girdle of Melian. The orcs can get in. I mean, they can cross the border, which they can't do in Doriath. But she has established a kind of girdle of protection that is at least reminiscent of Melian. So yeah, no, clearly you can see the fruits of this apprenticeship, and in its way, you know, it shows. This is the second time we've gotten Galadriel, and I think this second time helps to qualify that first time. The first time, she just looks like she's one of the hotheads. You know, she's one. I mean, if that were all we had of her, we'd have to put her on the pretty high on the sketchy list. That is, you know, of all of the, you know, of course, Feanor and his sons are like, you know, they are the sketchiest, but you know, of those who were kind of thinking like them and were with them and who therefore are potentially kind of themselves at risk, Galadriel is one of the top candidates. It speaks well of her, I think, that, you know, her sort of the first phase of her putting her "I would like to have dominion over a realm" plan into action is to basically study under Melian, you know, and say, okay, this is, if Melian is Galadriel's role model for how you rule a realm at your own will, you know, that's actually a really good role model and speaks pretty highly of Galadriel and how she's planning to go about this whole ruling a realm business. So that at least is comforting. Okay. I think we are, oh yeah, and Chris points out in the text here that this is why she wasn't allowed to return to Valinor after the end of the First Age, because she hadn't really she hadn't really yet fully repented. She had, you know, she does, although she's going about it in a comparatively admirable fashion. She still has that kind of resonant with Feanor outlook. She hasn't totally given it up, and so she doesn't return. It's among the reasons she doesn't return. Now, Tolkien kind of wavered over the course of his life as to whether or not she had been forbidden to return, or had she just chosen not to return. But certainly her non-returning, her plan, her goal, her dream isn't going to come to fruition really until, you know, in the Second Age and then through the Third Age, when she finally sets up her own realm and really has her own shop. And then, of course, this is why, for her, the refusal of the Ring of Power is the final culmination of her turning away from it. Okay, well, I think we're coming to the end of our time here tonight. That was good. That was a fun discussion tonight. Any last final comments or thoughts?
Yeah, we've decided, and by we I mean me, that everybody should turn their microphones on and say "Hell Caraxa" to end our seminar each week.
All right.
Hell Caraxa.
Hell Caraxa.
Hell Caraxa.
Yeah, I'll see you guys. Hell Caraxa. Good night. Godspeed.
That's all for this episode of the Silmarillion Seminar. Join us next time when we discuss Chapter 16 of the Quintus Silmarillion of Maeglin.
Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.